For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm producer Robert Kirkwood, and coming up in today's show,
S.D. Robertson introduces us to his new novel, How to Save a Life.
Charlotte Levin talks about her debut that came out during lockdown, If I Can't Have You.
Narrator Tamdeen Byrne reveals how he translated Irvin Welsh for talking books.
And we return to S.D. Robertson for the books of his life. That's all coming up in today's Read On.
In his first four novels, S.D. Robertson has built a reputation for writing emotionally intelligent stories that leave the reader appreciating what they have. And his latest book, How to Save a Life, promises to do the same. Its protagonist is forced to reevaluate his life after a near-death experience. Here's S.D. Robertson to tell us more. Stuart, welcome to Read On.
Hello.
So, for those who haven't yet picked up How to Save a Life, could you give us a bit of background?
Of course, yeah. So it's my fifth novel, and it's a redemption story about a man called Luke Craven, who's a bit of a curmudgeon. He's very much a glass-half-empty type, having been dealt several bad hands in life. There's a freak accident right at the start in which a stranger, a brilliant young doctor, saves his life, only to be killed herself. And the experience has a profound effect on Luke. It gradually changes his whole outlook on life. Knowing he's been given a second chance, he sets out to make it count, to try to become a better man in tribute to the woman who saved him. He starts small, saying yes rather than his habitual no, and soon this builds into something more substantial, a way for him to actually make a difference, helping people less fortunate than himself. But as life happens to do, it still has a few curveballs to throw at Luke, and his resolve to change does get severely tested as the book goes on. And as to whether he continues his journey successfully, you'd have to read the book to find out.
Well, certainly at the beginning, he's a wonderfully grumpy hairdresser of all things. One of those jobs where you think he really should be chatty and open with his customers and neighbouring shopkeepers, and yet he's not.
No, I quite like the idea of that. I've always quite fancied having a main character as a barber. I don't know why. It's always been a profession that interested me, in that they often are very convenient and chatty, etc. But yeah, I quite like the idea of this grumpy barber, just to be a bit different, really.
And I was really struck how his redemption comes about, as you say, because he feels that if this young doctor, Iris, has given up her life, he shouldn't waste his by being a curmudgeon. But part of that process is coming out of isolation and entering the community.
Yeah, it's quite fitting at the moment, isn't it? Because there's a lot of people coming out of isolation as we speak, really. So as it happens, yeah, quite suitable for the times.
And it has very much been a time where we have had to build communities to stop us feeling so cut off from the world.
Yeah. I think that's one of the key messages of the book, really, because at the beginning, he's very much alone. And I think the message of community and seeking help from other people, whether it's just friendship help or whether it's professional help when you have issues and stuff, it's the people around him as much as himself that enable him to make this change in his character. And without those people, I'm not sure he would be able to make it. But at the beginning, they're there, but he's not really open to them. And it's opening up to these people that have been around him already that makes the difference, really.
And you carefully peel back the layers through the book as to what has pushed him into that isolation in the first place. Yeah. And we learn that actually he's not unsympathetic.
No. I think that's the case with a lot of people. Usually, I mean, it's not always the case, but I think usually if people are a certain way, there's always reasons for it. In his case, there's very much reasons for it. He didn't start out as that kind of character. Life wore him down. He's been through a lot, really. He's been through the ringer leading up to it. As you say, it's sort of drip fed throughout the book as to why he's like he is. But there is very much a reason for that. And although it is very much a redemption story, it's also a story about bringing back his original self. I think everyone starts off optimistic, and the world can grind you down if it's not always easy. And he lets it grind him down, whereas the message of the book and what he tries to do is that you don't have to let it grind you down. With a positive outlook, you can turn things around and see things very differently.
Yes, and it's definitely a trope of all five of your novels. They are, as I said in the introduction, emotionally intelligent. You look for causes and consequences and ways out.
Yeah, when I first started writing, I don't think you always know what you write when you first start to write. And it's become more evident to me as I've continued writing that dealing with emotions is very much part of what I do. And it's not something I specifically set out to do. It's obviously something that does very much interest me, and it just comes out in all my books. I deal with grief a lot in my books and all kinds of other issues, you know, but my readers seem to really like dealing with the emotions, and I think they're not always dealt with enough, really, particularly by male authors. Often it's people say to me, I've not really read a book by a man or like this book with a male central character that is dealing with the emotions so much. Why not? There's something that everyone deals with on a day-to-day basis and a lot of people can understand.
I wondered also whether it's perhaps a northern thing as well, that northern men aren't meant to cry. They're meant to be tough.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some background to that. I think men in general, another sort of thing that's dealt with in the book is that he has issues, potential issues like survivor's guilt, PTSD, perhaps depression, and doesn't automatically seek out help. And again, that's very much a male thing. We are sort of brought up, whether it's a northern thing or whether it's just men in general, we're brought up as stiff upper lip, just get on with it. Don't talk about your emotions. Times have changed and it's not a very healthy way to be. And yeah, that's what I tried to convey, really.
And I was struck from reading the online reviews that actually you have a very good balance of male and female readers, which is not always the case for a lot of authors.
It's nice to know, really, because I want to. You do get the impression from being in the industry, and it's not something I was really aware of before I was in the industry, that there are a lot more female readers than men. That's certainly how publishers look at it. But there are also a lot of male readers out there. I know plenty, probably because of my own background. But yeah, I very much want to write for men and women. I want my books to be universally accessible, really. I'm not really like a florid, overly descriptive kind of writer. I like to write in a way that anyone can pick it up. I used to be a journalist, and that was a technique we were taught, is, you know, write for the every man or the every woman, the every person, and books should be for everyone.
You mentioned your 10 years as a local journalist.
Yeah.
And I always think that gives a great insight into all levels of the community, all levels of human nature. Mm-hmm. Was it a good apprenticeship for you?
It was. It sounds almost like I make this up, but I always actually wanted to be an author. But I finished university. I was an English graduate and came out of university not really knowing what I wanted to write about. And I thought, well, I want to write, so let's go into sort of a profession that will let me write. And I want to get some ideas. And journalism was wonderful for that. Working on local newspapers like I did, you meet so many different people from every walk of life. And as a reporter, you have to get on the level of the person you're dealing with, whether it's a homeless person who's struggling on the street or whether it's the CEO of a big company. And you meet so many different people and you meet so many characters. And obviously it kept my writing going and it honed my writing to a level where it was much better than a typical student English graduate. But yeah, the life experience of seeing so many people and things and areas that I'd not perhaps been to before. And yeah, it was wonderful. It was a fantastic place to learn to become a writer.
I certainly agree. My 3 years of working on the papers taught me also that truth is often stranger than fiction. So you should just allow your imagination to fly without being worried that it might be seen as preposterous.
Yeah, I mean, you encounter some really odd things on local newspapers, stories you think, well, how can that be? A lot of my fiction does involve otherworldly elements as well. I wondered at the first place whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, and I decided, you know, it's fiction, it's fun, it's something I enjoy, and weaving those elements into it, it's not in all my books, but it's in a lot of them, and it's something that I like, and why not?
And it's also given you a discipline to sit down and write every day as a job.
Yeah, it's something you often hear among advice groups for would-be authors and that kind of thing. It's write every day. And it's so true. I mean, you have to. And if you're like I am now, working from home, I'm currently on a deadline for my next book, and it's not due till the end of September. And it'd be very easy to not get around to doing it every day. But you have to, because it's the only way you actually get a book finished. As a journalist, obviously, you're taught deadline, 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 always meet your deadline. My final role, I was a editor of a local newspaper, and I always had in the back of my head, in all the time this paper's existed, which was quite a few years, maybe 150 years, something like that, it's always come out. And if I'm the editor that doesn't come out with, that's on me. So you always meet the deadline. And I just apply that to my writing life now. I say, I've got to write this many words, and come what may, I do. Or if I don't, I make myself catch up the next day.
And I understand that you have a constant companion whilst you're writing, and that relatives of his make regular appearances in your books.
Yeah, well, my cat, Bernard, usually it's just me and him around the house. Things are a little bit different currently. I've got some other companions due to lockdown. But yeah, my cat, Bernard's always around. And there is a character in this book, character that's a cat that is very similar to him.
And for a visually impaired audience who might not be able to look him up on your website, can you describe Bernard?
He's basically a tabby. There's a picture of him as a small furry little kitten on my website, sniffing a bottle of beer, I think. Quite a bit larger now. He's a little bit overweight, perhaps, in the prime of his life, let's say. But yeah, he's just a bit of a cheeky little menace who likes to jump on my keyboard and annoy me, but keep me amused.
Your five novels have all been brought beautifully to life as audiobooks by a selection of narrators, the most recent of whom is John Sackville.
Yes.
I see him in the mirror as a gust of wind sweeps him up to the locked door, his dark curly hair bedraggled and blowing from side to side. After staring at the close sign for a few seconds, he squints through the rain-flecked glass in my direction. I know exactly what's coming next, and my muscles tense up in anticipation. He tries the handle. Of course he does. And when the door doesn't open, instead of getting the hint, he knocks on it. Hello, he calls. Are you still open? Snarling internally, I shake my head. Without turning around to look at him or downing tools, I reply in a loud voice. What does the sign say? His answer is delivered with a satellite delay. But I can see you're still working. Bloody idiot, I think, refusing to look at him other than through the mirror. We're closed, I bellow, like it says on the sign. There's silence for a moment, and hope he's got the message. But my heart sinks as he remains huddled in the doorway, chin tucked into his flimsy coat, which clearly wasn't designed with a British winter in mind. Can you squeeze me in? He pleads. Won't take long. Come on, it's horrible out here. I'm soaked through and freezing cold. Can you cut me some slack? I squeeze my left hand into a tight fist and take a deep breath in a bid to stop myself from really lashing out. No! Try somewhere else. We're closed. Incredibly, he doesn't give up for another few minutes. He stays there, moaning and groaning, like it'll make a difference. But I tune him out and get on with the job in hand, no longer acknowledging him. Eventually, he goes away with a sullen, half-hearted kick to the door to mark his departure. And a few choice insults.
John Sackville, narrating How to Save a Life, written by my guest, S.D. Robertson. So, Stuart, do you have much to do with the selection of the narrators for your audiobooks?
I don't often have loads to do with it. There's a couple of books where I've been given a choice between this person and that person. The publishers have a good selection of people that they regularly use, and so far they've picked really, really well, I have to say. I mean, John Sackville does a great job on this one. Of my four previous books, the first one was read by a man, the second was read by a man and a woman, and the last one was read by a woman, and this one's read by a man. So it's always been quite interesting to see how different they all are and how differently they approach it. And I just think one of the trickiest things must be doing the different voices, because if you're a man doing the voice of a female child, which was something that occurred in my first book, Time to Say Goodbye, yeah, I find it difficult. If I ever do library readings and that kind of thing, I find it quite hard to know what level you do it. I think they do a fantastic job of really conveying this world into the minds of people who want to or need to listen to audiobooks rather than read.
Yeah, part of the reason I ask is because I've been struck by what a good ear you have for dialogue. And I was wondering if maybe you hear the voices of your characters in your head as you're writing the book.
Yeah, I think you do to a degree. I have to say, writing dialogue is probably my favourite part. When I get to a dialogue section, it just flows. I think it actually comes back a lot to writing on newspapers when you're doing quotes from people. That sort of maybe honed that. You remember how people have said things to you and you have to put it onto the page. And yeah, that's where it comes from, I guess. But I do love writing dialogue. It's probably my favourite part. And I think you do to a degree hear them in your head. And it's nice when you actually hear someone else doing that well on an audiobook and you think, yeah, that's what I wanted them to sound like.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I do listen to them, yeah, definitely. Bluetooth headphones have been great for audiobooks because it just gives you the freedom to wander around and listen to things in your own little bubble, whether you live outside in the garden or if you're going for a walk. I have an uncle who loves listening to them as he drives. I have a friend who only listens to audiobooks, not because she has a need to, but she just really likes audiobooks and nothing else. And they just seem to be having a real renaissance at the moment and doing phenomenally well. And that's great because there's still plenty of people who read, but there's so many other distractions these days with mobile phones and everything. And the younger generation, if there's another way to get people into books, where they can perhaps listen to books as they do their other things on the phone, or maybe the books create this world in their head and let them put down the phone, then anything that attracts more readers is brilliant because you want the book world to continue.
Absolutely. It's all about accessibility, and the more readers, the better.
100%.
And I understand that you have a favourite place for reading.
You're probably referring to the bath now, right?
I am.
I do like reading the bath. I don't know why. In the bath and in bed seem to be the two main places that I do read. Again, it's because there's so many distractions. And when you're there, it's just you in the room and whatever you take in the room with you. Mobile phones are awful for keeping you away from books. I'm as much as anyone, someone who's on my phone a lot. And you can read books on your phone, but I never do. I'm not a big fan of that. So when I do read, it's either a physical book or it's my Kindle. And I just usually go into the bath with those two, shut the door, and I'm off into my book until the bath goes cold and I refill it again, usually. There or in bed at night. My wife's often asleep when I'm reading in bed, and the Kindle with the backlight is wonderful for that. Otherwise, I get told off having the light on. But wherever you can, really.
Well, I am very conscious that I am distracting you from making progress on the sixth novel. Can you give us a sneak preview or a title, or is it too early?
It's probably too early. I don't really like talking about my books at this stage. The working title is My Father's Daughter. I can give you that. It'll probably change because they usually do. I don't even let anyone see my first draft until it's probably finished other than me. There is a synopsis that my publishers have, which I have to drag out of myself, really. I do like to plan it and know the beginning and the end, but I do like to let it develop along the way. But I never really let anyone see exactly what the manuscript contains until I've done my first draft and self-edited it, really. So that's all I can say.
I hope you'll come back in the autumn to tell us more about the new book. But in the meantime, we've got How to Save a Life to Enjoy. Stuart Robertson, thank you for taking the time out to appear on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
How to Save a Life by S.D. Robertson joins his other four novels in the R&IB Talking Books Library. And Stuart will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
Like many writers this year, Charlotte Levin's debut novel, If I Can't Have You, came out while the country was in lockdown. But judging by the glowing reviews online, that hasn't dampened readers' enthusiasm for the book. Charlotte will join me in a moment via Zoom. But for now, let's have a listen to the audio version of If I Can't Have You, read by Chloe Massey.
I often think about the first time I saw you, when they broke the news that Dr. Williams had been killed at the weekend. Dr. Harris and Dr. Short had gathered everyone into the surgery waiting room, even menials like myself, and Harris relayed the shocking details. You may as well hear it from me, as there'll only be speculation. Mrs. Williams. An argument. The car that hit him as he ran across the road after her. How he was still alive when the ambulance arrived. How he was dead before they could get him into it. I heard it all. The terrible events. The intakes of breath. Linda blubbing next to me. I heard. But it was you who held my concentration. You were the stranger among us. Kept your head down in respect. Or was it embarrassment? Your hair fell forward, draping your face in that way it does, and when you glanced up, your eyes, pale, unsettled me.
It's about a young woman called Constance Little, and she's left Manchester for London following her mother's death. She starts a job in a private medical surgery, and essentially, the book is about her. She starts a relationship with one of the doctors called Samuel Stevens, and she thinks she's found happiness and everything she's been missing in life, and then he ends it. And the story is essentially her descent into obsession and her unravelling. So on the surface, it's kind of a stalker novel. It has a thriller element, but it's really also about loneliness and attachment and how far we'll go to have that attachment to somebody in life.
It certainly hits the ground running. Tell us about that scene in the tube.
Yeah, so it opens with a young woman who you realise is Constance, and she's on a tube and she's in a wedding dress. She's covered in blood. She's got vomit in her veil and her tooth is hanging out. And so that's how it starts. And then the book starts from the beginning and essentially explains how she got into that state. It starts with a bang.
I was already old news. People stopped gawking, or were doing so more subtly, at least. They returned to their arguing, laughing, avoiding. Heads magnetically drawn down to phones. But then came the flashes. There was no doubt I'd feature heavily in conversations that day. Photo evidence was needed. I'd be trending on Twitter. Reading man glanced up from his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Perhaps he was wondering which one my habit was. But then that's what I love about London. Rather than staring, why didn't they ask if I was okay? In Manchester, I'd have been in someone's house by then, being handed a cup of tea with six sugars and a blue riband. The tube slowed to a halt. Earl's Court. I could see them on the platform waiting for me.
When Constance is with Samuel, as a reader, we can see the red flags, but she can't.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, that's how I wanted to write it. That obviously, it had to be from Constance's point of view. She just can't see it, even though the reader can. So it's sort of quite uncomfortable to watch her just continue with her behaviours, knowing all along that he's just very much not worth it and doesn't feel the same as she does about him.
And there was a thread on Twitter a wee while back that Constance isn't alone in ignoring red flags.
No. I did... A few years ago, my friend was staying for the weekend and we were talking about relationships and our exes and how did we know really before we went out with them. And that was opened up on Twitter for discussion and it went a bit viral. There was lots of people, because I think it's quite a common thing that we see red flags, but generally in hindsight, after the event, and we'd sort of willingly ignored them as the relationship was happening because we liked the person. So that's very much what Constance is doing in this.
And for everything that Samuel does, he sees himself as the good guy.
Yeah, I think it was very important. I mean, I didn't want to make him, you know, just a stereotypical baddie. I think it was important that everybody, Constance and Samuel and other characters, do you believe that they're doing their best in life? So he's more oblivious to how awful he is. I mean, he is awful consciously sometimes as well, but I think he's quite oblivious to his behaviour because he's so innately selfish that he's just driven by what he wants to do. But that's the same with Constance and her relationship with Dale. And, you know, I touch on that towards the end, that do we, as people, we... You know, we're often very unaware of how we can affect other people.
Now, you obviously wrote this before the current situation, but do you think there's a certain relevance about loneliness and isolation, especially during lockdown?
Yeah, well, I've not seen anyone for 5 months, so it feels very relevant to me right now. Yeah, I mean, loneliness is a huge theme in the book. Constance talks about being in London and being around 9 million people, but it's irrelevant because if you don't have that connection, we can feel very lonely regardless of how many people are around. But I should imagine that during the past few months, loneliness has hit a lot of people quite severely, and possibly people who, I mean, I'm a bit of a loner anyway. I'm an only child, and I must admit, I do like my own company and I live on my own and I work from home. Even this is too extreme for me, but I'm probably more used to it than the average person. And, you know, there's a lot of people that were just literally thrown into not being able to see anyone. And I should imagine that that's really hit a lot of people very hard.
What about as a writer? Have you been writing much in lockdown?
Well, you'd think that it was the perfect opportunity to write. And I've found it incredibly difficult. I mean, I am a writer. I started writing my second book, but for some reason, I mean, I do suffer quite badly with anxiety, and I was quite anxious when all this started. I'm used to it now, but it just wasn't really a situation to get your creative juices going. Just going out, or you see things or you hear things, and it triggers things creatively, and just being in the same four walls isn't really conducive to that. So I found it personally quite difficult. At the beginning, I thought, great, I'm going to write a first draft of my next novel, and I'm currently on chapter 3. So it didn't quite go to plan.
Now, the audio version of If I Can't Have You is read by Chloe Massey. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
I didn't have choice, but they sent me who they thought they wanted to read it to ask my opinion, and I was really happy with who they picked. I've not listened to it all, but I was actually quite into it. It felt a very weird experience listening to your own book. But I thought she did a fantastic job. I was really pleased with who they picked.
Dr. Harris hadn't been speaking long before Linda felt faint. With difficulty, her being built like a walrus, I eased her round the country life-covered coffee table and onto the nearest section of modular seating, before fetching her a glass of water as instructed. You stood in the doorway. I could smell you. Lemons. My hand brushed yours as I passed, but I didn't acknowledge you or smile. Merely walked on as if you were a ghost. On my return, you'd moved further into the room, meaning there was no accidental touch. As I'm sure you'll remember, Linda's reaction was stronger than everyone else's. Possibly even that of Mrs. Williams. It was always obvious she'd had a thing for him. We, Linda, myself and Alison, were responsible for all the doctor's admin, as you know. But Linda coveted Dr. Williams's work. I could identify the glint through her cloggy eyelashes each time she had to go to his office. Poor Linda. The speculation was that Mrs. Williams was running away because she'd caught him with another woman. Another woman who wasn't Linda. It wasn't just his wife whom Dr. Williams had betrayed. I remember feeling conscious that I didn't look upset enough, or shocked. Even the unfriendly agency nurses, or the ratchets, as I called them, looked emotional. But I was just as shaken and moved by Dr. Williams's fate as everyone else, only I'd lost the ability to express. As you know, with me, it's all inside. Always inside.
And I believe you've recently got into audiobooks yourself.
Yeah, well, because I was doing this and I thought, I've never actually listened to an audiobook. Because I've got a really short attention span, and I didn't think I'd be able to concentrate on it. And I did. And I read a book. Well, I listened to a book over the weekend, Daisy Jones and the Six, and it blew me away. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So now I think I'm an audiobook convert, to be honest. I can't wait for my next one.
Well, since we're on the subject, we have a section on the show called Books of Your Life. Well, what book made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, I think I mentioned to you before, because basically I never read as a child. I wasn't brought up in a sort of very booky family. Well, my granddad read loads, actually. That's not true, but my mum didn't. And so I never really read much. But as I got into a teen, I was very into acting, and I consumed plays, and I read them like books. And particularly one play called Road by Jim Cartwright, I was completely obsessed with as a teenager. But in terms of books, the first book, and I haven't read it since, so I may not even like it now, was Catcher in the Rye. My auntie gave it to me, and I just was so engrossed in it. And I remember I was visiting her in London. I was about 18. I was reading it on the tube and walking with it, reading, and I was completely obsessed with it. So that's the first time I realised that you could actually be completely engrossed in a book, as opposed to plays and things which I'd been reading prior.
If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it. In the first place, that stuff bores me. And in the second place, my parents would have about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all, I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell. Besides, I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me around last Christmas before I got pretty run down and had to come out here and take it easy. I mean, that's all I told DB about, and he's my brother and all. He's in Hollywood. That isn't too far from this crummy place, and he comes over and visits me practically every weekend. He's going to drive me home when I go home next month, maybe. He's just got a Jaguar. One of those little English jobs that can do around 200 miles an hour. It cost him damn near 4,000 bucks.
The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger is available from RNIB Library, and it's read by Marvin Kane. Now, is there a book on a rainy day that you go back to and reread again and again?
I'm not a massive rereader, to be honest, but there is one book. I haven't read it again for years, though. But in terms of like on a rainy day, when I have read it, I've just consumed it in a day and it's perfect. And that's Breakfast at Tiffany's by Truman Capote. I thought that I didn't need to read it ever because everyone knows the film, but I think it's so much better than the film. It's a bit grittier and it hasn't got that Hollywood ending, and it's really short. So it is perfect rainy day reading if you just want to go from start to finish on something. And that would be my recommendation for that.
I am always drawn back to places where I have lived, the houses and their neighborhoods. For instance, there is a brownstone in the East 70s where during the early years of the war, I had my first New York apartment. It was one room crowded with attic furniture, a sofa and fat chairs upholstered in that itchy particular red velvet that one associates with hot days on a train. The walls were stucco and a color rather like tobacco spit. Everywhere, in the bathroom too, there were prints of Roman ruins freckled brown with age. The single window looked out on a fire escape. Even so, my spirits heightened whenever I felt in my pocket the key to this apartment. With all its gloom, it still was a place of my own, the first, and my books were there, and jars of pencils to sharpen, everything I needed, so I felt, to become the writer I wanted to be. It never occurred to me in those days to write about Holly-go-lightly, and probably it would not now except for a conversation I had with Jo Bell that set the whole memory of her in motion again. Holly-go-lightly had been a tenant in the old brownstone. She'd occupied the apartment below mine. As for Jo Bell, he ran a bar around the corner on Lexington Avenue. He still does. Both Holly and I used to go there 6-7 times a day, not for a drink, not always, but to make telephone calls. During the war, a private telephone was hard to come by. Moreover, Jo Bell was good about taking messages, which in Holly's case was no small favor, for she had a tremendous many.
Peter Whitman reading Breakfast at Tiffany's and Other Stories by Truman Capote, which is available in the RNIB Library. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yes, I will actually recommend the audiobook because, to be honest, I've really been in a reading slump since the lockdown, and I've found it really hard to concentrate on things, and I have enjoyed some books, but this book gave me absolute joy from start to finish. I completely loved it. I thought it was fantastic and so unique and well done. And I don't know, to be honest, if I can't imagine it working as well to be read, though people have corrected me on that, but it's just such a good audiobook. I highly recommend it. It's Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Daisy Jones was born in 1951 and grew up in the Hollywood Hills of Los Angeles, California. The daughter of Frank Jones, the well-known British painter, and Liane Lefebvre, a French model, Daisy started to make a name for herself in the late 60s as a young teenager on the Sunset Strip.
Elaine Chang, biographer, author of Daisy Jones, Wildflower. Here is what is so captivating about Daisy Jones, even before she was Daisy Jones. You've got a rich white girl growing up in L.A. She's gorgeous, even as a child. She has these stunning big blue eyes, dark cobalt blue. One of my favorite anecdotes about her is that in the 80s, a colored contact company actually created a shade called Daisy Blue. She's got copper red hair that is thick and wavy and takes up so much space. And then her cheekbones almost seem swollen. That's how defined they are. And she's got an incredible voice that she doesn't cultivate, never takes a lesson. She's born with all the money in the world, access to whatever she wants, artists, drugs, clubs, anything and everything at her disposal. But she has no one, no siblings, no extended family in Los Angeles, two parents who are so into their own world that they are all but indifferent to her existence. Although they never shy away from making her pose for their artist friends.
Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is narrated by a full cast, including Jennifer Beals, Benjamin Bratt, Judy Greer, and Pablo Schreiber, and is available commercially. Charlotte Levin, thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Charlotte. If I Can't Have You by Charlotte Levin is available in audio, print and as an ebook commercially now. We've got another Books of Your Life coming up later on in today's show, but for now, let's go through the Read On archives and hear from a narrator. Tam Dean Byrne was in the RNIB Glasgow studios recording the Irvin Welsh book Blade Artist, just as T2 Trainspotting was coming out in cinemas. A coincidence too good to pass up.
Choose life. Choose Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and hope that someone, somewhere cares.
Missed you, mate.
I missed you too, Spud.
T2 is loosely based on the Irvin Welsh books Porno and Trainspotting, both of which, and the prequel Skag Boys, are available from the RNIB library, along with the books Filth and Glue.
Hello, Franco.
Simon.
I'm home.
But if you've seen T2, you may be wondering what happens next. As I said, the films are only loosely based on the works of Irvin Welsh, but in one of his latest books, The Blade Artist, we discover the unusual direction Francis Begbie's life has taken. It was recorded by Tam Dean Byrne in the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow.
As he elevates her skywards, the bright sun seems to burst out from behind Eve's head, offering Jim Francis a transcendental moment that he pauses to savour before he lowers the child. The hot sand will soon punish his bare feet, he thinks, turning away from the solar flare, and he'll have to watch she doesn't burn. Eve is fine for now, though. A bubbling machine gun giggles, urging him to continue the game.
A clip of The Blade Artist played with the permission of Penguin Random House and Irvin Welsh. The voice behind it, Tam Dean Byrne, joined me to tell me about The Blade Artist.
Well, Begbie is back. In essence, Francis Begbie returns to Edinburgh because his son's been murdered and he gets into all sorts of exploits.
Franco sets about trying to piece together Sean's last days. His first port of call is the flat in Gorgie, where his son met his demise. It is tucked down a sunless, tenemented side street at the back of Tynecastle Stadium. Canals of moss grow between its cobblestones and a deathly stillness and silence pervades.
Now, last we heard from him, he was being hit by a car at the end of Porno. Where is he now?
It's funny, that comes up quite a bit. He's got a bad leg, definitely. He's been 8 years in jail, but he's become rehabilitated and become a very successful artist and has moved to California. He's been in California for 6 years, I think. He's very settled, married there, two kids, and has completely changed his life around.
Is it still the same Begbie, though?
Yeah, well, it's the way that it is with people. That's what it explores. It's like, can people change? Can people change completely?
He certainly feels he doesn't feel connected to that Begbie again, but obviously once he gets back to Edinburgh, it starts to have its effect.
Now, you've done almost all of Irvine Welsh's books. Have you got any favourites?
Oh, I think virtually all of them. They're all really so special in their own way. This is quite different, again, from any of the others. I really see the qualities in them all. I couldn't say. I mean, obviously, Filth is very close to me because I did it as a one-man show, which I've just recently managed to get. I've put it up on my Vimeo, actually, as well. People could have a look. I did the show in Canada, Calgary, and I got it filmed back in 2003. And I never actually ever saw the film get made, but I just got it transferred, and I put it up on my Vimeo page. And the whole of the show is there, and that means a lot to me. It's just each one that comes along seems to have its own qualities, really.
Now, when you mention Filth there, a lot of Irvine Welsh's work doesn't really lend itself to audio, particularly in Filth, where the words of the tapeworm overlay the words of the narrator. How did you work around that?
Well, what we did then is we recorded, because you can see the other words underneath, we did a sort of double track type of thing where you had my voice coming through as and now. Yeah, they managed it on that one. There's some others like Marabou Stark Nightmares. I didn't do that one, but I can see the trickiness that would have been in that. I think he doesn't get enough recognition for the quality serving, the way that he plays around with words on the page so much of the time, which is obviously tricky to be able to get across for audiobook. And I don't know what it would be like on Braille. I don't know how they would manage that. Yeah.
At Glasgow's I Write Book Festival, I asked Irvine Welsh about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really. It's funny because you don't really think about that as a writer. You know, you're trying to tell the story, and then you realise there's all these different mediums. You know, there's kind of you think about. You know, you don't really think about the audiobook. You don't really think about the possibility that might be made into a film. You don't really think about a stage play or anything like that. You think about it very much in the medium that you're writing in the book, you know. So, but I think they just, you know, in terms of sort of kind of translating it to different medium, I think just people have to be a wee bit creative about it, you know.
You are sort of stymied when you're doing an audio version because your creativity is limited by the fact that you've got to produce an audio version of the text itself.
My friend Tamdeen Byrne does the audiobooks, most of the audiobooks for me, and he's an actor and he's very good, and he did Filth on stage and he did the tapeworm on stage, so it helps having somebody like him involved.
The RNIB version of Filth is narrated by Jonathan Hackett, and to give you an idea, here's a couple of passages.
Then I'll get myself charged up for our little specialist club's activities. I have to keep it going. Keep going for the tedious ritual of putting Alfior's son through it.
Eat! I eat through my skin, and I hold on with my jaws. Slowly, so slowly, I'm consuming the matter that surrounds me, ingesting and excreting through my body, through my skin. I have to eat to move on, to consume, to live, to consume.
What is it that he's trying to say? Help, police, hospital. Or was it?
Help, please, hospital.
It doesn't really matter. That little point of detail because his life is ebbing away.
Human existence distilled to begging for the emergency services. You pushed me away, mister.
You rejected me. You tricked me and spoiled things between me and my true love.
Jonathan Hackett reading from the RNIB version of Filth.
Now, I produced the RNIB talking book version of Glue, and I think I used about 6 actors on it, and you did that on your own.
I did.
How was it going from, like, Juice Terry to an American girl and all of the other characters that are in there?
I didn't remember it being particularly so. I mean, these were abridged in a way. That's what was trickier in the past, is that most of them were always abridged. I did more, the very first one back with Trainspotting, where the pair of us did it, it was abridged on cassette, it was way back then. But we did an unabridged version of Trainspotting just a couple of years ago. And we also did Skagboys fully, and Decent Ride has been fully, and this will be, and that's what's great now. I'd love to be able to go back and do them all again, do the whole shebang. But yeah, you just have to write it a lot of the time and then get the sort of, rather than just sort of thinking, you can't completely transform your voice really in it. Well, I can't really. So I just try and find the essence of the character in myself, because often you can relate to the characters. That's what's great with it.
So it's a narration rather than a performance.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you are narrating, but it's sort of, you're also trying to make it in the moment as well. There's interesting sections in this one where it's Bigby recounting these circumstances when he was a young teenager, and it's all written in italics, and it definitely needs to have a different feel, but it doesn't really tell you what that would be. So I sort of tried it as if he was maybe in a psychiatrist's chair, almost like that as well, but he's reliving his youth, so it does have a sort of teenage quality to it. But yeah, you just play it by ear, really.
Now, the last time I saw you on TV was in Sky's production of Fortitude, set way up at the edge of the Arctic Circle. What was that like?
Oh, it was a lovely job, yeah, because it was four trips to Iceland I got out of that. And I got killed by, eaten by a polar bear in the first scene of the first episode, but fortunately they extensively used flashbacks, so I appeared in quite a few episodes. And it was a mate of mine, Simon Donald, who was an actor, who'd written it. I think he got me the part, really. Yeah, it was an amazing piece of work.
Let's see, you were a bit of a nasty character in it, and yet the next day you're reading Julia Donaldson books to children.
Yeah, I mean, just you couldn't make it out sometimes, an actor's life, hey diddly-dee. It was because I'd said to them, look, I have to finish on this day, the 13th of June, I think it was, because I had committed to this, following the baton around the country, Commonwealth Games, attempting to read all of Julia Donaldson stories to kids. And there was no way anybody else could do it. I couldn't pull out of it. So I thought, I'll probably lose this job. And that would have been a bummer. But they accommodated that and made sure that all my stuff would get done. And so the exteriors were all in Iceland, but the studio stuff was in London. So I had to finish that day, and I had a really hardcore rape scene to film that night, and they had to extend and get me a later flight back up. But it was really, really was tough stuff. And then the next morning, I was in the Children's Wood up in North Kelvin Meadow, just up here, doing Superworm with Julia Donaldson. Amazing.
Hold the funny face, move your eyes and nose and mouth all over the place.
So we're moving from the Gruffalo to Bigby. Would you recommend the Blade Artist?
Absolutely. It's another amazing piece of work from an extraordinary writer. Yeah, totally, totally. I hope folk will enjoy it. Yeah, but it is pretty hardcore. It is.
And find out what happens next with The Blade Artist by Irvin Welsh, read by Tam Dean Burton. Available commercially now. And a quick update, since that interview, Tam has returned to the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow to record the follow-up to that book. It's called Dead Men's Trousers. Again, it's available commercially.
Now it's back to S.D. Robertson for the books of his life. Stuart, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, the book I would pick for that, and it was the first one that popped to mind, was Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce. I remember reading it as a boy, probably through school, and it just really resonated. And it probably would resonate with children now due to the fact that the main character is a boy in quarantine with his aunt and uncle after his brother gets the measles. He's not allowed to play out, and he's lonely without his brother or other children. And effectively, he discovers this sort of midnight world where there's this big garden that doesn't exist in the daytime. And it's just magical. Really, really fantastic book. Love it. And I read it with my daughter when she was growing up as well.
And yet, in spite of his assurance to Hattie, Tom continued secretly to consider the possibility of her being a ghost. For two reasons. Firstly, that there seemed no other possibility. And secondly, and Tom ought to have seen that this was the worst kind of reason, that if Hattie weren't a ghost, then perhaps that meant he was. Tom shied away from that idea. On the afternoon of the quarrel, he had been impressed, although he had been careful to hide this from Hattie, by her method of argument. She had a girl's quick eye for clothes, and she had used it on this occasion against him. Tom wished that he were able to do the same kind of thing, but he found that he remembered only vaguely the appearance of the people of the garden. He had, it was true, a strong general impression that they were not dressed like himself and his uncle and aunt, but old-fashioned was the nearest that he could get to the difference. Both Susan the maid and Hattie's aunt, for instance, had worn skirts nearly to the ground. Naturally, their clothes would be old-fashioned if Hattie were a ghost. Yet to prove her that, he must be able to put an exact date to the clothes in the garden, and so to Hattie herself. He thought he knew where he could find information. He had often noticed on his aunt's kitchen shelf, together with Mrs. Beaton's and all the other cookery books, a volume invitingly called Inquire Within Upon Everything. Now, when his aunt was out shopping, he slipped out of bed and borrowed it. He looked in the index for clothing, styles of clothing in the past. There was nothing under styles or under past.
Elizabeth Proud narrating Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pierce, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, that'd have to be The Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. Amazing love story, amazing way of dealing with time travel as a rare genetic condition, which I'd never encountered before, and as something unwanted rather than sought. And I just found it intensely moving and unforgettable. I believe there's a sequel in the works, which I hope is as good.
Saturday, December 22nd, 1991. Henry is 28 and 33. Henry. At 5:25 a.m., the doorbell rings, always an evil omen. I stagger to the intercom and push the button. Yeah? Hey, let me in. I press the button again, and the horrible buzzing noise that signifies welcome to my hearth and home is transmitted over the line. 45 seconds later, the elevator clunks and starts to ratchet its way up. I pull on my robe. I go out and stand in the hall and watch the elevator cables moving through the little safety glass window. The cage hovers into sight and stops, and sure enough, it's me. He slides open the cage door and steps into the corridor, naked, unshaven, and sporting really short hair. We quickly cross the empty hall and duck into the apartment. I close the door and we stand for a moment, looking ourselves over. Well, I say, just for something to say, how goes it? So-so. What's the date? December 22nd, 1991. Saturday. Oh. Violent femmes at the Aragon tonight? Yep. He laughs. What an abysmal evening that was. He walks over to the bed. My bed. And climbs in, pulls the covers over his head. I plop down beside him. Hey. No response. When are you from? November 13th, 1996. I was on my way to bed. So let me get some sleep, or you will be sincerely sorry in 5 years.
Russell Bentley narrating The Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger, which is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, that'd be Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano, which is about a 12-year-old boy who's the only survivor of a plane crash in which his parents and brother die along with nearly 200 others. That's really, really good. Part coming-of-age story, part magnificent character study of a group of very different people all about to share the same terrible fate. Really recommend that.
Newark Airport is shiny from a recent renovation. There are potted plants at each joint of the security line to keep passengers from realizing how long they'll have to wait. People prop themselves against walls or sit on suitcases. They all woke up before dawn. They exhale loudly, sputtering with exhaustion. When the Adler family reaches the front of the line,
They load their computers and shoes into trays. Bruce Adler removes his belt, rolls it up, and slots it neatly beside his brown loafers in a gray plastic bin. His sons are messier, throwing sneakers on top of laptops and wallets. Laces hang over the side of their shared tray, and Bruce can't stop himself from tucking the loose strands inside. The large rectangular sign beside them reads, "All wallets, keys, phones, jewelry, electronic devices, computers, tablets, metal objects, shoes, belts, and food must go into the security bins. All drink and contraband must be thrown away." Bruce and Jane Adler flank their 12-year-old son, Eddie, as they approach the screening machine. Their 15-year-old son, Jordan, hangs back until his family has gone through. Jordan says to the officer manning the machine, "I want to opt out." The officer gives him a look. "What'd you say?" The boy shoves his hands in his pockets and says, "I want to opt out of going through the machine." The officer yells, apparently to the room at large, "We've got a male OPT. "Jordan," his father says from the far side of the tunnel, "what are you doing?"
Cassandra Campbell narrating Dear Edward by Anne Napolitano, which is available from the RNIB Library. SD Robertson, thank you so much for sharing your love of books and the story behind your own books with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm @RedSail, which is REDSZELL.
And I'm @talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.